Welcome back to Can We Fix It? I hope you guys all had a lovely holiday. As I sit here wrapped in my comfy blanket, Kahlua in my coffee, listening to the thunderous sound of what I'm assuming must be a WWE fight going on upstairs, I keep trying to put myself in like a peaceful mindset, but I think we can all agree that 2020 fucking sucked. First and foremost, Dunkin' Donuts discontinued dark roast. What the fuck, Dunkin'? Has 2020 not been cruel enough? John Mulaney is in rehab, which, like, okay, it's fine. Do I believe in anything anymore? Oh, and right, obviously, the fucking plague. Still. I mean, it's really hard to not want to focus on the shit show that was 2020. But I decided that this year in review is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be about, you know, the winners of 2020, because some people still managed to make it out on top in, you know, all the horrible things that were going on. Some people still managed to make it out on top. We're going to start off with the number one winner of 2020, Jeff Britt. That man managed to successfully beat the speaker at his own bullshit. He had the forethought to recognize that he was working for a real piece of work, and kept receipts of everything that he was doing, kept all the emails and the text messages, and managed, you know, during what started as a real court case and then moved to a virtual courtroom, to successfully beat those charges, and simultaneously to reveal the former Speaker of the House, Nick Mattiello, to be either incompetent or incredibly malevolent. And either way, I am absolutely certain that we owe Jeff Britt some amount of credit for Nick Mattiello losing this year. Which brings us to our close second, which was Barbara Ann Fenton Fung, real MVP of 2020. Her win itself was really impressive. I think when they broke it down, Nick Mattiello spent like $90 a vote to lose. Like, that's how much money he spent, like over $300,000 on this campaign. I also personally really loved Fenton Fung's ad campaigns. Like, she did like a game of criminal guess who with Stephen Frears, and, you know, just like went through a whole bunch of the people that had like gotten into legal trouble on Nick's team on his watch. She also did a supercut of all the times that Nick Mattiello, while testifying in front of the grand jury, said, "I don't know" or "I don't recall." That was dope. Like, that was straight up dope. And she also knew when to, like, not be a dick, right? So, like, early on, Nicholas said something about, "Oh, I don't know that there was slavery in Rhode Island." And Gene Valicenti was like, "There was definitely slavery in Rhode Island," which, like, for Gene Valicenti to have to correct you on that is like, that's embarrassing. And Barbara Ann, instead of being like, "Meh, dumbass," was just like, "You know, it's good for us to know our history. And like, it would be easy to make fun of him for not knowing it, but like, we need to, you know, put more effort into like recognizing that, you know, the things that Rhode Island did." And I was like, damn, girl, like, If it's all an act, it's very convincing, but she seems like she seems very charming and very reasonable. In third place, we've got Senate President Rubbers Ruggiero and his leadership team. He barely fended off that challenge from medical professional Lenny Seo this past year. And, one thing I will say for the Senate president is he recognized that progressives won a really big victory this year, and he swung left, right? In a lot of policies, right after he won his race, he really started swinging left to try and appease a lot of the more progressive senators. I do have a story about how that leadership vote went because I'm told that it was super duper weird. So Senator Sandra Cano had been on the fence about whether or not she was going to vote for Gail Golden or Ruggiero, and she and a couple of other, I'm trying to think of who else, were like wishy-washy about whether or not which way they were going to go. So she got a chairwoman seat out of the deal, and I'm sure some sort of promise of like some kind of legislation that she wants going through. But it's not enough that you just like succumb to the leadership team, right? Like they also want you to like do a little fucking dog and pony show and kiss their asses in front of everybody. So that everybody else knows that they've gotten you in line. So Senator Cano has to like give this, glowing review of Majority Leader Mike McCaffrey and, just all the wonderful things that he's done and, what a great leader he is and is going to continue to be. And like, again, it's not enough for you to just say like final vote on your leadership team. You have to also like, adhere your lips to their butthole. So she finishes this like very glowing, very kind review of McCaffrey. And he comes up and says, "Thank you, Anna Quijada," or "Thank you, Anna." And she goes to sit down. There are like two Latina senators, and this asshole was like, "I got a 50-50 chance of getting it right," and called Senator Sandra Cano by the other Latina woman's name. And I put that emphasis in my brain. It's like, what kind of dickhead can't even be bothered to learn the names of the people that they sit with, like, 3 days, whatever. So it was just one of those like instant karma things of just like, you had to sacrifice your dignity at the altar of the fucking leadership team just to be called by the wrong name before you sit down. And, part of me wonders if it's on purpose, if it's some like fucking, like power move of just like, "Alpha male, I don't learn your names." Anyway, I'm getting off topic. Fourth place in this winner's list goes to Senator and now Rhode Island Supreme Court Judge Erin Lynch Prada, who proved that you really can just like climb that ladder, baby. Revolving door stuff aside, it kind of seems weird to me that you would get to be a sitting senator, and as you're still sitting as a senator, now they're going to vote you to be a Supreme Court judge. Like, that just doesn't feel right. And also, there's a lot of lawyers in that room. Do you honestly think that any of them feel comfortable, like, telling her no? Because then they're going to hear cases in front of her. And what? Just like hope that she doesn't remember or hold it against you? Like, that seems like a really terrible plan. As I mentioned, I didn't get to go to the budget because I had a slight fever. But I would have been one of the only people who would have been allowed to recuse myself from that vote. I very much wanted to vote no on that appointment. However, Senator Lynch Prada was my baby daddy's lawyer during our custody proceedings many, many years ago. And I, in my way, made it fairly clear that I did not think that she was a very nice person. And I was very worried that if I voted no, it was gonna look like petty as hell. But like, that's not why I was voting no. But like, I can't prove that. So I definitely would have recused myself for that vote. Just like, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what recusals were designed for. And I never recuse. I never step away on a vote. Like, I don't do that shit. I think that's like a cop out. But like, in this particular case, like, that feels like a real conflict of interest. And it was fucked up because I like didn't really know who she was at that point because I was just starting to get into activism. And so halfway through our court proceedings, because it lasted like a year or two, I was like at the state house for something and saw her in the Senate chamber. And I was like, oh no, now I'm going to lose the court case and the lobbying. This isn't going well. And finally, in fifth place, proving that white men tend to fail up, Chris Millay, who literally lost his election, you know, one term representative, and immediately was given a city solicitorship. It must be nice to just be able to like fail up like that so regularly. Particularly when in the beginning of the year, and I will never forget about this, February or March, right before we were about to adjourn, as it would turn out forever, Chris Millay brought in a jumbo cardboard cutout of his own face on a stick. And now coronavirus was already happening. There were already people in Rhode Island with coronavirus. It was already like a problem on a national level. And the vibe was very, frat party. So Chris Millay would like pass the Chris Millay cardboard cutout around, and you know, the Mario Mendezes would, you know, shake it up and down and be like, Chris Millay agrees with this bill, Chris Millay doesn't agree with this bill. And it was like, oh, very yuck, hilarious, while people were like already getting sick and not doing well, and then lost his subsequent election and then gets a city solicitorship, because you gotta just, you know, fail up, baby. And just so we're clear, when I said the winners of this year, I didn't mean we had to like it. although we did have some amazing progressive successes. I am of the mindset that I don't particularly care who gets the credit as long as something gets done. I recognize that not everybody agrees with that strategy. Up at the State House, I don't have a single bill that has my name on it, but I was responsible for passing a lot of very important legislation because I was willing to not require the spotlight all the time. So, a lot of these successes, you know, they can be attributed to various groups. Whether or not those groups are going to get the credit is, you know, up for grabs. But I think that it's very clear that this new tax the rich policy, there was a bill put in the Senate side by, I believe it was Conley, and on the House side, it was Alzate, Karen Alzate from Pawtucket. And it happened to coincide with the Rhode Island Political Co-op coming out with their metrics for a higher tax bracket, a higher tax rating on the upper echelons of the Rhode Island citizens. And lo and behold, just a couple weeks later, Conley puts this bill in to tax the rich. So that's, you know, the first success is getting actual traction with our tasks and projects up there. And you know, as I said, the Senate president really swung left when he realized that that was where the electorate was going. And then you've got the Rhode Island Political Co-op, which started out as a joke to a lot of people. It seemed very ambitious, very unlikely. And now is, you know, being credited with, you know, running dozens of candidates and succeeding with a lot of them. The Rhode Island Political Co-op is, I think, a new brand of community for candidates who don't feel like they're necessarily welcome in the Democratic Party. I know I said when I joined the co-op that, like, this must be what it feels like when the Democratic Party cares about you, right? Where, like, everybody's helping you and everybody comes to your fundraiser and everybody, you know, tells their friends about your campaign and they knock doors for you. And, like, I had never had that in the Democratic Party because it was always, you know, at the end of the day, run by Nick Mattiella. Like, Nick picks the person who's going to be the chair and he tells them what they're going to do. And now that will be Joe Shakarchi and Chris Blazewski, which good luck and God bless them. The longer, like, little side note, the longer they've been like the elected speaker and majority leader, like, the more worried I am that they're not super prepared for what the fuck that job entails. Because I thought at first that they were like being vague with like press and colleagues because they like we're trying to play it close to the vest. But now it kind of seems like they genuinely have no idea what the fuck they're doing, which I don't understand because they were both on the leadership team before. But I guess because Nick had such an iron hold on it and was such a fucking micromanager, they probably didn't get to, you know, like, you know, handle any of the minutiae of that shit because Nick was such a, you know, dictator. Or the other possibility is that they're being vague because they don't intend on changing anything. And it's going to be like another dictatorship, but just this time with like slightly less scumbaggy individuals. Side note on that side note, I mentioned there was Kahlua in the coffee, right? Okay. I am getting a little fucking sick and tired of how meaningless the word progressive is. I also feel like the word progressive should be given and not taken. So, Like, I don't know who the fuck got to decide that Chris Bledsoe was a progressive. I don't understand that. And the fact that people keep writing about him, like, oh, there's a progressive at the table. I'm like, where? I don't see one. I see a man who, like, puts nice things on his mailers, but then just, like, does whatever the speaker tells him to. That's not progressive. It's not progressive to, like, sell your soul in exchange for meaningless titles and pablum, like, whatever. Which brings us to progressive youth activists, because these kids were the real fucking MVPs this year. Holy shit. Like, the scale, the consistency, the directness of their message. The youth are, like, fucking killing it. You've got the climate activists who, I mean, they're good, dude. They're real good, and they're polite, and they're kind, but they are relentless. They will call every day. They will send you 10 emails. They will wait by your desk. Like, they don't give a fuck. There are some new up-and-coming young feminist Planned Parenthood activists who organized several rallies at the State House when it was still open, and then virtually and throughout the course of the coronavirus, who are keeping an eye on domestic violence statistics and, like, spreading awareness about what's going on in people's homes during coronavirus. The kids are, like, just straight up killing it. I used to do Generation Citizen at the State House, basically, like, groups of kids would do a project on a bill that they wanted to become law. And I got a lot of calls. They had great ideas, from, you know, how to reduce recidivism to, like, you know, getting rid of the tax on tampons. I answered all their questions. I went and saw their presentations. They were all very well done. One of the young ladies called me after one of the Black Lives Matter protests, because she was helping to organize a bail fund for one of the protesters who had been arrested, and immediately thought to call me. Like, these kids are just invested in a way that, I mean, I guess is probably survival at this point, right? Like, we've left them like a fucking desolate landscape of a planet. But damn, they're like at 15, I was just finding new ways to skip school, you know, and these kids are, like, successfully, there's no longer a tax on tampons. You know what I mean? Like, these kids are succeeding at everything they try at, and it's deeply impressive. Which also ties into the next success, the budget success. One of the things that I do think about Bledsoe and Shikarchi as leader and speaker is, I think that they care more about public perception than Nicholas did. Like, Nicholas was very much like, fuck you, I do me. And, like, you know, mind your business. And if they wrote nasty stories about him, he wasn't, like, he didn't super give a shit. Whereas it seems like Joe and Chris can kind of be guided by shame, if that makes any sense. Like, you can shame them into doing the right thing. You can publicly shame them into doing the right thing. You can media shame them into doing the right thing. It seems like they do care more about the public perception than Nick ever did. So, you know, and that was very reflective in the budget negotiations. Now, one thing I will say, because I'm a bitter, bitter cynic, is that I think it's a very smart play to constantly cut in budgets, you know, cut city aid, cut municipal aid, cut pilot, cut this, cut that. Because then we're constantly forced to just fight for what we had. And we can't ever ask for more because we're so busy just fighting to not have cuts. And part of me wonders, again, very cynical, whether, you know, that's the game, right? Is that like they don't actually intend on cutting these things. They just want to keep you from asking for more municipal aid. And so to do that, they just say they're going to cut all of it so that the only thing that you have time to focus your energy on is like, please don't do that. Please don't do that. Please don't do that. And then they look like the benevolent, you know, good listeners that they are. And they, well, we heard you all loud and clear, and we'll put it back in the budget because we're such good guys. And it's interesting to me because I feel like Governor Raimondo has kind of a different strategy when it comes to her budgets. What she usually does is I call it the South Park strategy, right? Where you put in like way more swears and dick jokes than you need to, so that the censors will cut a bunch of them, but like not all of them, and then you can get in more than you want. So she usually comes out with fairly reasonable budgets, right? With like one or two just like objectively fucking terrible things. It's like, you know, and free college and, you know, more money towards schools, and we tax the elderly extra for being like a drain on our society. And you're like, whoa, Jesus Christ, Gina, what the fuck was that? And then she's like, oh, okay, I guess I'll cut that. And like she kind of gets you on the shock and awe, like when you know, she says she's gonna give like $0 to Medicare and Medicaid, and you're like, whoa, what the fuck? And then, you know, she'll like back it up and be like, okay, you guys convinced me. And I feel like that's so she can hide shadier shit in the budget elsewhere. But I think that Shekarchi and Blas kind of use the opposite strategy of just like, oh, we're cutting this, even if they didn't really have any intention to. So that brings us to the other success of this year, which is weed past the Dutch upon the left-hand side. So everybody who's anybody has known that marijuana legalization was coming down the pipes in Rhode Island for quite some time, but the old-timey mentality up there of like, meh, it's a gateway drug, you see, kind of put the damper on that for way longer than it needed to be. I think Rhode Island really missed out in a big way because during coronavirus, dispensaries in Massachusetts were just fucking making money hand over fist. And therefore had their budgets set up in a much better way because they were getting this reoccurring revenue. Whereas Rhode Island relies so heavily on gambling revenue from the lottery to Twin River and all that fun shit, that when all our stuff got shut down, we took such a fucking hit. So one of the things that the Senate president said when he got his seat back was that he was going to consider legalizing weed. He was talking about you know, $15 minimum wage. John Mulaney has this great bit about marijuana. We're like, it's the only thing in our lifetimes where we just kept like poking the government, like, excuse me, until eventually they gave in. And I know that there are people who feel very strongly one way or the other. I personally am of the mindset that marijuana legalization in Rhode Island is going to do way more good than harm. So I also want to talk about some honorable mentions. People who you know, had quite the year themselves, and it really could have turned out to be wins, but but maybe they lost it by just a hair. So number one, we've got Scott Zambrano, who ran for Aaron Lynch Prada's seat against Kendra Anderson, got his ass kicked and turned into like this caricature of an angry, like sore loser. Like his Twitter and Facebook right now is off the fucking chain from everything, from like Kendra stole the election and, you know, it was all, you know, the election was all like a hoax and blah, 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 like very Donald Trumpian, to he like threatened the Secretary of State that like if she didn't recount the votes in his race, then like he was going to like file charges against her or something. Just like real full on meltdown, which if you weren't such an asshole, you'd feel bad for. Another honorable mention, John DePietro, friend of the pod, I say with heavy sarcasm, John DePietro, who was so fucking convinced that there was going to be a goddamn purge in Providence, that like we were in the throes of some Mad Max style unrest, and that, you know, the fucking inner city youth, as everybody knows, we're just gonna, you know, fully lose their shit and start eating people. Weirdly, that did not transpire. Thank God he was prepared for it, though, you know, and that he prepared us, that he was the one, John DePietro, the, you know, weird little melted popsicle that is that divisive, angry radio show host, was so ready to just like come to downtown Providence with his cell phone and like record the carnage. And then nothing happened. We have the final honorable mention, which the reason he's in the honorable mentions and he doesn't get to count as a winner is because I don't even know how we should feel about this, but Ramon Porntabs Perez. I don't know if we have told the ballad of Porntabs yet. Basically, it goes a little something like this. Ramon Perez, when he was a representative for Providence, had a bill that he was going to be that was going to be heard in Finance Committee. And generally, when you are presenting a bill, you give them the text of the bill. You give the committee members some supporting information. Maybe give them a little packet, frequently asked questions, things like that. And then you have your witnesses who do their testimony. Ramon, like any good technologically deficient adult, rather than print out the page of information that he needed, must have been on like a tablet or something. So when he's looking at the information, he just screenshots the screen of the tab where he has looked up the information. Apparently, unbeknownst to him, all of the other tabs that were visible in the screenshot were porn. MILF, teenage MILF, hot teenage MILF, just, you know, a plethora of porn. Now, when you do a screenshot, obviously it gives you the timestamp and date and all that fun shit. And I want to say the timestamp was at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Ramon, when all of this shit hit the fan, swore that it was his friend who had done the research for him and sent him the screenshot, and that he was deeply embarrassed, but he wasn't going to, you know, sell his friend out and say that, you know, who the friend was that did it. And my thought process was very much like, that's a good fucking friend. You know what I mean? Like that you would text your friend at 4 o'clock in the morning when he's mid masturbation and ask him to do your job for you. And that he would just literally drop everything to Wikipedia or Google this question for you and then send it to you. Like, I can't even get a friend to pick me up at the airport at 4 o'clock in the morning, let alone like stop mid-wank to do my job for me. So Porntabs Perez won his comeback tour. He was ousted by Mario Mendez last cycle. Mario Mendez was very much a useless placeholder for the year and change that he was up there. And then Ramon won his seat back. I happen to have a bunch of friends in that neighborhood and have heard multiple stories about how Ramon managed to do that. And basically, whenever he would bump into a voter, he would be like, you know, I want you to promise that you're going to vote for me. And then he would say, I want you to promise God that you're going to vote for me, which, like, bro, you're really fucking playing hardball here. You know what I mean? Now I got to lie to Jesus, or I got to lie to your face, which personally, I would have just told him, like, to his face, like, yeah, I probably don't bring Jesus into this, Porntabs. But yeah, he rewon his seat, which, more power to him. I feel deeply terrible for that entire community who has just had, like, scumbag after dipshit after scumbag after dipshit, and like has never gotten a representative who's like competent that they deserve. Because if we recall, before Ramon Perez, it was John, wrap a towel around your face so that nobody knows who you are, Carnivale. So this poor community has just like suffered through like dipshit after dipshit. And then, you know, is rewarded with Ramon again. So, you know, that's the last honorable mention that we'll do. Let me know if you guys think that there were, other highlights that I missed, other winners of 2020 that I didn't acknowledge. And hopefully next week we will have my hype man, Jason Royce, back in the game. He had to take the day out today. I am very much looking forward to the new fresh batch of people who are going to be sworn in within the next week or so, come to think of it, because I'm very interested to see how the rest of this year goes. How this is going to go with the new leadership, rather. I still can't tell if they are, if they're planning on changing anything. Again, I mentioned they've been very, very vague about what their plans are. And part of that, I thought, was them playing it close to the vest. But the more time passes, the more I'm thinking that maybe they don't plan on changing anything, and that everything is more or less going to stay the same up there. I also think it's interesting that Shikarchi is really trying to have his cake and eat it too, in a way where he keeps swearing that he didn't know anything about the budget, and the budget is such a complicated thing. And once he, you know, became speaker-elect, he started getting all this help on the budget. But then when the budget passed, proceeded to take credit for all of the good things that came out of it. And I don't know how well that's going to work for people. One thing that can be said for Nicholas was that at least he was always honest with you to your face. You know what I mean? Like, you would say, you know, I want this bill to pass, and you'd be like, fuck you, that bill's not passing. Which sucked, but at least you know where you stood. I get the impression that Shikarchi and Blas are very much telling everybody what they want to hear, and then they're going to do their own thing anyway. And I'm very curious to see if the people of the house are more or less upset with having a speaker who just lies to them and tells them that everything is going to be fine and then fucks them over anyway, as opposed to a speaker who tells them straight up, like, fuck you, I'm not doing that. So it should be really interesting. I think probably it's going to take them a little bit longer to figure out that they're being played, if they're being lied to. But I also don't think that it sets Joe and Blas up for a particularly long-winded run as speaker and leader if they're starting off by just bullshitting people and bullying them. Say what you will about the Senate president, but he greases palms, he smooths obstacles, he when people want something, he will give them something. But from everything I'm hearing about Shekarchi and Blas, anything that is being asked of them, they are refusing to agree to, from gender equity and racial equity to democratically elected chairs and things along those lines. They are refusing to commit to any of that. And a thing that I think is very interesting is that the media, for whatever reason, is just like fucking eating this shit up and is writing about these two like, they are the fucking saviors of Rhode Island, which is just really weird to me because they haven't fucking done anything yet. So, I think it's I think it's very interesting that the media has decided already that they're a better option than Nicholas was. And perhaps, again, perhaps that's just because they're charming. But this is very much what I was worried about with this leadership team was, for better or worse, Nick was a complete dickhead. So it was really easy to convince people that he was not nice and he was not doing things in their best interest because he was objectively not a nice man. And then now I worry that because Joe and Chris are charming and kind and polite, that it's going to take people. Particularly people in that room a lot longer to realize how nefarious they are. So I think that's going to be a real problem coming up. And hopefully I'm wrong. Again, hopefully I'm just bitter and cynical and I assume the worst in everybody and that they're actually going to be great. But I don't think so. Tune in again next week. If you guys have any ideas on upcoming pods or have any questions that you want answered about your local government, tweet at us. Join in the conversation at patreon.com/canwefixit. And let me know what it is that you are wondering about this upcoming legislative year. Our podcast is now available on Apple, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify. Feel free to subscribe to any of those to stay updated, or to catch up on previous episodes. I'm actually going to be a guest on Uprise's other podcast this week, so good luck getting rid of me. My voice will be in your ears always and forever. Stay safe, wash your fucking hands, and go be a good neighbor today.